You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. Coming up on today's show, this is no longer a migrant crisis, this is a humanitarian crisis. We ask, are perceptions on migrants and refugees changing? Also ahead, after another attack by Al-Shabaab in Somalia, we discuss what resources lie within the African Union to confront the group on a long-term basis. And when a newspaper openly declares its political allegiance, is it fair for politicians to call them out for being biased? All that, plus America's HBO shoots a movie adaptation of President LBJ's time in the White House. Are our opinions of leaders altered by fictional portrayals? That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today, Daniela Pellet and Martin Plaut. Welcome both to the studio. Let's begin with the image of the lifeless body of a three-year-old boy lying face down on a beach in Turkey. It's made the front pages around the world. The little boy was one of 12 Syrians trying to make it to Greece. His picture has brought home the human cost of a crisis that until now has arguably been referred to in general terms of numbers, nationalities, quotas. This past week has seen refugees confronted at the Macedonian border, protests at Budapest railway station, and more than 70 people suffocating in a lorry in Austria. Martin, let's just look at the way that this migrant crisis, I think one commentator has said this is no longer a migrant crisis, this has become a humanitarian crisis. When did that shift happen?
I think the scale is just is really the issue. I mean, you know, there have been, after all, people coming into Europe for, you know, for decades. It's not been an issue. But the combination of the situation in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa and the Horn of Africa, and, of course, the huge crisis in Syria has just transformed that. And we now have numbers on a scale that are just, you know, it's taken off in a completely different way.
When was it that you noticed there was a shift, Daniela? I think a lot of people have said that it coincided with the discovery, with the picture of this little boy on the beach. Had we just not really noticed anything, or had there not been a face put to the crisis before that point?
Well, I think the shift is happening now, you know, today, yesterday and today. I mean, it's noticeable that the British government are changing their policy. They're trying to make policy on the hoof. They're running to catch up. The message that was coming out of 10 Downing Street this morning, it was notably different to what they're saying now, which is taking a much more compassionate tone. And I think in Europe, certainly, the... it's a very, very, very rare occasion where a movement on social media has actually made a difference to policy and to people on the ground. Sharing this little boy's photograph and also first-person account and also what other people around Europe are doing. I mean, the idea that in Iceland people are welcoming refugees into their homes, the idea that this is, you know, in Hungary, despite the nationalistic discourse, that people are also welcoming them, greeting them in German train stations. Something has happened. A major shift is happening right now in Europe. And I don't think it's just, I mean, I wondered perhaps the British attitude is changing because we don't like to be, you know, outdone by the Germans. You know, how can the Germans be taking in more refugees than we are? But I think despite our kind of island nation idea that we're slightly xenophobic and suspicious of outsiders, and UKIP got a few votes in the last election, when there is a human face, when it is there's a human face and there's something that people can do, whether it's delivering a tin of beans or sending socks to Calais, it's made an enormous difference.
Daniela was talking there about the idea of policy making on the hoof and how Downing Street, at least in the United Kingdom, has been trying to catch up with what appears to be public sentiment that is racing ahead of itself. How is this going to be playing out in the geopolitical sphere, Martin, when we have Angela Merkel, who obviously is in charge of a country which has taken a radically different stance to the acceptance of migrants into the country than the British have? Will Angela Merkel suddenly find this as a not necessarily something to play David Cameron with, but something that can show the British up to not necessarily being the Europeans that they could be?
Well, I mean, clearly that is the case because the Brits are, you know, they're not part of Schengen, therefore they are not required to take anybody. I mean, it's just not part of the deal. But I mean, there is a huge acceptance in Germany. The opinion polls show that the Germans back Angela Merkel in what they're doing. I don't really know what the British feel. I've not seen an opinion poll which really shows it. I mean, what was extraordinary this morning was that I signed a petition calling for Britain to take more refugees at 100,000. It's now reached nearly 250,000. So there has been a vast shift very rapidly. But of course, you don't know what the silent majority think. You know, there are clearly perhaps hundreds of thousands, perhaps even millions of people in Britain who believe that something should be done. But does this translate then into a majority? That I don't know.
And one wonders then, Daniela, when you have this overwhelming rush in the United Kingdom, at least to sort of be seen as being more welcoming, when you compare the practicalities between and the mindset between the likes of the United Kingdom and Germany, for example, or Hungary, Spain, wherever, one wonders whether the Germans are better prepared for this kind of thing because they have not only that that determination to be welcoming to refugees, but they also have the systems in place, the integration, the help for people who are trying to find jobs. Systems like that just don't exist in many European countries, do they?
I don't think the systems exist really across the board for the crisis, at the scale of the crisis that we're looking at now. I mean, the best thing that can come out of this, and I don't mean just, you know, sacks of pasta going to Calais, but actually a sensible discussion in Europe on a strategy to deal with migration and refugees, and a sensible one. I mean, it's impossible for a few countries, for Italy, Greece, Spain, Germany, to take the full brunt of the number of people coming here. I don't think there are the systems, even in Germany, I don't think the systems can cope. Schengen, it makes a mockery of Schengen, really, now. The idea that, well, okay, Britain isn't part of it, so it doesn't have to participate. Schengen worked very well when things are going well, like the euro, when things are going well, fine, no problem. Now we've got problems with both of them and no one quite knows what to do.
Is this the moment, Martin, therefore, when Europe, like it perhaps it has done with the likes of Greece, gets tough but has the long-term benefit and the long-term thought of Europe in its heart?
Well, I think that this will require those two nations that hold Europe together, and that is France and Germany, to stand united and to be determined. I mean, one of the most damning things that one can say about David Cameron is that he, you know, Britain is nowhere in any of these discussions. He's complete. Britain is just irrelevant. But Germany and France are still holding things together, and as long as that happens, I think Europe will be all right. I mean, it is interesting that tonight both the leaders, Hollande and Merkel, have got together and hinted to the East Europeans that if you muck us around on this one, Schengen will be at risk. And guess who is keenest on Schengen? It's the East Europeans, because they're the ones that really benefit from it. But, you know, I just would never underestimate the depths to which any crisis can go. And I have here a headline from the Daily Mail of 1938. German Jews pouring into this country. That's about Britain. I would never underestimate how deep the far-right positions can go and how badly this could all end up. It's a really dangerous moment.
There is that nationalist sentiment that does need to be recognised, doesn't there, Daniela? That if you look at the likes of Hungary, 98% of asylum claims in the last year have been refused, which is why all the asylum seekers are desperate to get on a plane to Munich. To what degree does this require a sort of a recalibration of the way that Europe deals with the far-right? Because there's going to have to be a balance struck somewhere, isn't there?
But it's a curious thing, human behaviour. I think the governments have been, across Europe, have been scrabbling around trying to ease this populist sentiment. They say, well, it's anti-immigration. I look at the worst that Britain managed to produce is UKIP, really, but much, much worse phenomena elsewhere in Europe. But I'm on this occasion, rarely, I'm a little bit more optimistic than Martin, and I have to say, I think governments will, again, look towards populism. And over the next few weeks, we're going to see, until that there is perhaps a backlash, we're going to see people flocking to refugee centres, making donations, bringing people into their into their houses. I think there is going to be a popular movement to welcome refugees. And governments, you know, will have to pay attention to that as well.
You're talking about governments paying attention. In the last couple of days, David Cameron in the UK, his reaction has been to, instead of deciding to open the doors to those fleeing, has suggested that peace in the Middle East needs to be explored first. it's quite a statement.
It's a ludicrous statement. I mean, to be fair to David Cameron, again, a rare occurrence for me, he did want to intervene when Assad used chemical weapons in 2013. It was a rare moment of vigorous foreign policy. But to say at this point that somehow bringing about peace in any part of the Middle East is within Britain's remit or within Europe's remit is ludicrous. And as I said, I think his line has been changing throughout the day, and it's going to carry on changing because he's not keeping pace. He's not keeping pace with public opinion at all.
One could argue that Cameron has always been more about tactic rather than strategy. In what case, Martin, do we need to see Europe thinking more long-term strategy? Because at the moment, people are talking about quotas, numbers, where to allocate these people. But once these people arrive, it was Angela Merkel 2 days later said, we need to accept the fact that these people are not going to go anywhere once they establish themselves.
Well, there is a great British contribution that could be made, which is to open the sovereign bases in Cyprus, bring all the people there, then you can sort out who is a refugee and who is an economic migrant. Economic migrants can be put on the plane back, and the refugees can be sorted out and allocated properly. Are the Cyprus government going to agree to this? Probably not. And is Britain going to agree to it? Probably not. But there's one way of solving the problem.
You have to ask the question, though, that even, you know, regardless of what their reasons for moving, to make that effort to travel the Mediterranean in those conditions, frankly, to put them back on a plane is not something that another one human being can do to another, is it?
No, but it isn't. But not to refugees, but there is no way that Europe can take all the people who would like to arrive as economic migrants. I think that is the distinction that has to be made.
But I think the distinction is getting increasingly hard to make. I mean, I was trying to puzzle this out in my head today, how anybody from any part of Syria could not be viewed as a refugee. You could say the same for Eritrea.
Sure, but somebody from Senegal, you know, who arrives here, or from Nigeria, not the north, there's no reason why they're here.
Where do you draw the line then, Martin?
Hard. It's tough. Of course it's tough. But that's the point of being rational about this. There is no way that the entire African population can arrive just because they're poor.
We move to Somalia now, where at least 40 UN and Somali troops have been killed in an attack by the terrorist organisation Al-Shabaab. 100 people are currently unaccounted for. The group raided the military base in the south of the country in the latest episode in a long-running insurgency in the country. Martin Plaut, explain to me the scale when it comes to this attack by Al-Shabaab. How serious is this?
Oh, this was serious. This was really serious. They overran the Janali base, which is about 90 kilometres southwest of Mogadishu. They held it for the best part of 4 to 5 hours. They blew open the main gate, and there was no way that the UN troops who were there, most of them Ugandans, could hold it. I've been speaking to the United Nations in the last couple of hours, and they put this death toll somewhat lower, possibly in the mid-20s. They certainly extracted 25 body bags. The Ugandans are saying they only lost 10 to 12. So, but I mean, it looks as if it is higher than that, but it is a big setback.
You talked about being in contact with the UN. The UN Security Council has condemned the attack. What else can it do?
Not a lot.
Daniela?
A vote of confidence for the UN Security Council.
The brevity of Martin's answer says an awful lot, but also asks a lot more questions. I mean, what should the UN perhaps be doing?
Well, I think there is international appetite and funding for continuing fight against Al-Shabaab in Somalia. The Ugandans that seem committed to it, the Kenyans are pretty into it as well. I saw an opinion poll, I think, today saying it showed a majority of Kenyans supported the ongoing fight against Al-Shabaab because it threatens their own security. And certainly the international community sees Nairobi as key to the fight against al-Shabaab. I mean, that was not a small reason, perhaps the reason that its president and vice president of Kenya managed to escape trial at the ICC. So I think...
Is that cynical?
Well, I mean...
Martin, there is that sort of interconnection that I think it would be perhaps a little naive to ignore.
What you're assuming is that the judges were leaned on by the international community.
No. What I'm saying, no, quite the reverse. I'm saying that that Nairobi didn't cooperate, perhaps quite as much as it could have done, providing the information that the court requested, and there wasn't international pressure on Kenya to cooperate to the extent that they could have done. I mean, it's just not in international interest. Stability in East Africa
is
much more important. So I think, yes, internationally, the fight against al-Shabaab it still remains a priority.
Daniela, though, was talking about international cooperation. We have the UN, which you've argued is arguably toothless. We have the African Union. We have forces from Kenya and Uganda. A lot of the troops who were killed here were Ugandan. To what degree is there a concerted, consensual effort here? Or is al-Shabaab actually able to profit from the fact that people aren't talking to each other?
No, it is a regional effort. I mean, that's why I was, I don't think the UN has much of a role in it, except, I mean, they pay everybody. So, you know, thank you, Uganda, for providing the men and who end up in the body bags. But the reason they're there is because the Ugandans, of course, have an interest in doing this. But don't forget there were attacks in Uganda. But also because the United Nations pays all these people and pays them well. And so it's a way of financing the Ugandan army. But I mean, the people who are really committed to this fight now are the Kenyans, as you pointed out, Daniela. But of course, above all, the Ethiopians. And they have troops all the way along the border and deep inside Somalia, and they will never allow this to get out of control. They will go on to the end because it is their existential interest to do so. Burundi is also there, so it's a regional effort that will contain this. And in the long run, I'm fairly optimistic actually that something can be done about al-Shabaab. Partly because, of course, the actual form of Islam that they are propagating is not one that is native to Somalia. It is, unfortunately, if one's going to trace it back, in the end, like all these damn things, it goes back to the Saudis and the Wahhabi influence, which is unfortunate but true.
You mentioned there the UN being the paymaster. Mm. It today has urged all these states which you have mentioned to cooperate actively with the Somali authorities. How likely is that going to happen? And how good are the Somali authorities at this?
Not very good. I mean, they are better than they were. I mean, one time the arms shipments were arriving in being flown in and being offloaded on planes and then being taken straight through to al-Shabaab and being resold by the Somali government, you know, who were just pocketing the money. So you can see, that was a very brief operation. But, you know, Somalia is a very useful place. I mean, the CIA, for example, owns a chunk of the airport and uses it as an interrogation centre. There are all sorts of things that go on in a country that doesn't quite function.
Daniela?
Yeah, I think also the situation in Somalia is the classic situation where you have an insurgency, which you have to fight, but then you also have to, it's all become almost a cliche, you have to stop disillusioned young men with no jobs, no economic prospects, being radicalised, etc., etc., etc. I mean, this is a real, it's a cliche, but it is a real issue. And Somalia is just at the beginning of this journey. Hopefully, with the right international support, they might actually be able to make a difference.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here. This is Emma Nelson, joined by Daniela Pellet and Martin Plaut today. Coming up next, we discuss bias in the media and whether a film that portrays a historical figure could ever be considered a piece of history. Stay with us.
The Monocle Minute is a just-launched daily email bulletin covering all the topics we're passionate about, from global affairs to retail news, finance to urbanism, architecture to transport. Packed with opinion and reports from around the globe, it's a unique briefing on the day from our editors and correspondents. Go to monocle.com to sign up for free today, and we'll send you the Monocle Minute to your inbox every weekday and deliver you a special cultural roundup at the weekends too. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world every day of the week.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the programme as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, a programme that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
Welcome back to Midori House. We're live in Studio One. The time here in London is 18:20. I'm joined in the studio by Martin Plaut, who's a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and co-author of the book Who Rules South Africa, among many other things that you do. Martin, your children's book career will be discussed perhaps another day. Also in the studio, Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Now, one of the comparative advantages of the broadcast media is the fact that here in the United Kingdom, at least, television and radio stations bend over painfully backwards to maintain their impartiality. Not so, of course, with print, where, here at least, political bent is used as a selling point. Well, when it comes to elections, the most sensitive of comments can, of course, lead to all manner of problems. And in the United States, the New York Times has been accused of waging a war against the Clintons. The newspaper has responded by accusing the family of paranoia. And we're still more than a year away from the presidential election process. What fun. Daniela Peled, are they at war, or is this just papers versus politicians?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's quite a compelling story. I quite like the idea that there's some sort of institutional memory at the New York Times that means over decades and over sort of generations of dynasties, you know, they can have a bias against the Clintons. I think most people watching the observing the elections would see this as more or less inside baseball. But, I mean, it's unusual because you expect papers to take a certain stance. You know, I have this argument a lot with people that who expect journalism to be unbiased and think that's the same as being free and fair. And it isn't, really, it isn't. You know, you can have quality journalism which takes also has a political agenda. I think various of our newspapers in Britain do it quite well. Of course, you also have thinly veiled electioneering, which I think we can come on to in a moment.
There is that joy, actually, of when you work in broadcasting, that when you manage to offend both parties, you know you've done your job, Martin.
Yes, and I mean, you and I have both worked for the BBC. You still do, I don't. And the, you know, in all my career, I was never able to express any opinion of any kind, and nor should I have. And that is the glory of working for the BBC, is that you don't have an opinion. And although you can stress certain things more than others, that's fine. You know, but you don't have this bias. But I mean, on the other hand, as you say, the British press are wildly biased. And you know exactly what you're getting from all of them. But what that brings me to the New York Times, which is the surprise for me is that anybody is surprised by their bias.
You know, is it biased, cares? Though, or is this, as Daniela has sort of rather deliciously alluded to, that someone might have a really big file that when you are a newspaper journalist for the New York Times and you sit in your editorial meetings, the opportunity to have a go at the Clintons is seized upon, you know, with relish.
But I mean, all the other papers take very strong political views. The problem is surely with the New York Times. That is the issue. Because the New York Times is surely one of the very few genuinely national papers in America and the bastion of liberal democracy in America. That is why the Clintons are so worked up about it. Not just because it's any old newspaper. I mean, you could have had the Atlantic Mercury. I don't know if it exists. But, I mean, they could have taken any position they liked on the Clintons. They wouldn't care. But it's because of what the New York Times is and where it stands in American opinion that is so toxic for them.
The executive editor of the New York Times, Dean Baquet, has said that politicians, as a rule, like to deflect criticism by blaming the press. Would you agree with that? Because you deal with an awful lot to do with Israel and the fact that the hugely outspoken nature of Benjamin Netanyahu often becomes a very interesting political football in the press.
Well, certainly Netanyahu used the media enormously in his election campaigns. You know, there's a newspaper, a daily, free daily newspaper in Israel called Yisrael Hayom, financed by an American mogul, Sheldon Adelson, which was basically created to have Netanyahu elected, and it duly did so, and it continues to do so. Now, this isn't the only reason for the rise of Netanyahu and his continuing popularity in Israel, but this is a paper, a normal everyday tabloid paper that people give out free in shopping centres and train stations, and has crosswords and has, you know, holiday features and so on, but whose raison d'etre is to have Netanyahu elected and keep him government, which is media bias taken to the extreme of the extreme.
Should papers have an openly political bias, Martin?
Well, it doesn't bother me if they do, because, you know, you know what you're buying. You know what you're picking up. You know, you want to have a paper which supports the Labour Party, you pick up the Mirror. If you want one that supports the Tories, you pick up, I don't know, the Telegraph or the Sun, or a heck of a lot of the papers in Britain. So you know where you are, and you know exactly what sort of positions they're going to take. It doesn't bother me in the slightest.
And I think again, you know, once again, banging the drum for Britain, that I think we do it quite well in the British media, that you can have quality right-wing journalism and quality left-wing journalism with an agenda, with some notable exceptions. But I'd say that we managed to strike that balance often quite well.
I wonder whether we can have enough mainstream, middle-of-the-road quality journalism. That is the problem that I often find when I'm trying to find a British newspaper that can that doesn't bang a drum in the background. Daniela, the communications director of the Clinton campaign, has gone on the attack. She's complained bitterly about the paper's apparent abandonment of standard journalistic practices. Now, if you were sitting in Hillary Clinton's campaign trailer, not yet built, I suspect, but is probably on order, would you say that this is the best way of doing it, is to actually go on the attack with the New York Times? Because surely that's just red rag to a bull, isn't it?
Well, if you pick away and pick away at the stories they've done over the years, you can find some holes. You know, New York Times, home to the famous Jason Blair scandal. I mean, you can attack as the best form of defence, etc., etc., etc. But I agree with Martin. I don't really see how the New York Times is going to be what won it or not for the Clintons. I mean, is that endorsement really that influential? It's a pity that this level of, you know, descent to this level of journalism already, and sort of backbiting and accusations, because it would be great to see some serious journalism on Clinton. All we've seen so far are the emails, and I haven't seen anything very exciting really come out of that. So it would be good for her to be under scrutiny, but a little more substance would also be nice.
I mean, just finally, do you think Donald Trump gives a damn what the New York Times says? I don't think so. He doesn't complain. He knows they don't back him.
Finally, the playing of an historical figure, especially a political one in the cinema, can often create a public legacy of the real man or woman, right or wrong. Let's quote Nixon, the Iron Lady, even to a degree the very loose interpretation of Bill Clinton's life in Primary Colours, pivotal moments being shown in a leader's career and a human side that an audience will grasp easily and, of course, retain. Well, another president is about to have his life put on screen. After picking up a Tony for his portrayal on Broadway, Bryan Cranston is set to take the role of the US President Lyndon B. Johnson in an upcoming HBO adaptation, All the Way. Martin, when I heard TV adaptation, I thought, does this make a difference to the quality of the material that we're going to get? Does Lyndon B. Johnson only merit telly as opposed to a big screen adaptation?
Well, who could say that now, given the quality that HBO puts out? I mean, you know, they put out some of the finest material that I've seen. And, you know, LBH is just an extraordinary, larger-than-life figure, one of the most interesting American presidents. So I think there's plenty to be said about him, and I think he'd make a great figure on the screen.
Daniela, very briefly, do you often find it frustrating, perhaps, or in delicious, that when a pivotal moment in a historical figure's life is portrayed on screen, that actually people kind of remember it to be fact?
No, people love it. I mean, the absolute delight of watching W, for instance, where Oliver Stone, and watching out for all the familiar figures of the mid-2000s and the run-up to the Iraq War. But bizarre enough with that film, in particular, knowing Oliver Stone's general political stance, actually W turned out to be no less sympathetic than I didn't have a high opinion of him before I went into the film, but afterwards it was about the same.
You fell in love. Daniela Pellet and Martin Plaut, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. That's all we have time for today's programme. My thanks to our producer Ben Ryland, our researchers Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Aidan McLaughlin, and our studio manager Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Ben Ryland will nip out from behind the glass and bring you some great global music. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thanks for listening.